So we are on page 48, right, of the notes, where they get a little faded, because we were running out of toner on the copier, and but now we have black copies. So. But we're talking about on the map of Jerusalem, and I did find a couple of pictures that I might try to incorporate when we get to the Silent Wednesday of the Passion Week. Maybe we can see some slides without going through all of the slides that are associated with Mark 12. And but where we're at is that Jesus, again, has had control of the temple complex. He has set up in the court of the Gentiles. We're now going to be going up. Oh, they can't get in because there's no door. Now they can get in, and because there's only one door to get into this area, so they have to go through this door, and they're huge doors. From what Edersheim describes, doors that were over 35 feet tall, something like that. So it was not a one-man deal, and they didn't have the handicap push-button thing that would open the door for you. The priests had to open those doors at a certain time of the day, and then they were closed at a certain time every day. But Jesus is going to transfer from this area, and they're going to go up into the court of the women. Now, what that's going to do is it's going to reduce the size of his audience. Okay. Because the Gentiles who have been able to listen to him out here, remember, Mark is, I think, the only gospel, right, that says when he kicks out the money changers and all that, he says, "You have my Father's house is to be a house of prayer for all the nations," whereas Matthew doesn't include that. Okay. But Mark does. And so those people, the Gentiles, can no longer come up into here. So for the Jews who, excuse me, I'm going to cough. Sorry. For the Jews, they come in here, and when you come in here into the court of the women, it's not just for the women, because the men have to go through there to get to the court of Israel. Right? So, but the women can't go any further than this wall, and then there's yet another massive doors, set of doors here, and a whole series of steps that are here, and to work your way up into this, into the court of Israel, where the actual sacrifices take place. Okay. And then you get to the holy place and the most holy place. Now again, this is probably not accurate scale-wise, but this is one massive building complex, okay? And on the entire Temple Mount, you know, it's somewhere close to 250,000 people can fit up on that level platform. It's huge. So we're going from here. Excuse me, I got something in my throat. But we're going from here over into here, and it's in here where they the offering boxes. Okay, that's what we're going to talk about. And everybody has to go through there. And everybody, this is a peer pressure at its finest. Because if you're going to come through here, come through the door, and go through that door, you better put something in the box. Okay. And that's what is recorded here. Excuse me. I'm not sure what's going on with my throat. In Mark 12. So Jesus chooses this location in the court of the women, verse 41. And the Greek word that's used here is not just to look, but it's what you would do at a theater. Okay, it's the root of our English word theater is from here. So he sets up And he is observing with great detail. Okay? And hearing this read or seeing this, that's the word picture that would come to your mind as you're hearing this for the first time. So Jesus is sitting opposite the treasury, opposite the offering boxes, and he is observing. This is what people do in the back of the auditorium when you come up and put your offering in the box, right? No, nobody does that. But Jesus deliberately does this. And now he's going to make a big deal out of it, okay? Which everybody enjoys, right, about your offering. So he's going to observe from God's perspective how people put money in the temple treasury. Verse 41 tells us how the crowd is putting in their copper coins. And it says, many rich people were putting in much. One last cough here. I think we're good now. So the many rich people were putting in large amounts. And if they're coins, and they have to be the right kind of coins, right? Because it's the Jewish temple, and they control what kind of money you put in the temple. And if Calvin and others who've written about this, these offering boxes may have been metal. Okay. And they may have been shaped in such a way. Remember they used to have those silly things at some of the stores? You put your coin in, it would go, and then it would... Not quite that elaborate, but you can kind of get the idea. So if you're wanting to impress people on your way from here through the Court of the Women up into there, you would want to make sure you threw in a lot of coins because it would sound impressive, okay? Now, they might all be pennies. That's not the point. Point is you put in a lot of coins, right, depending on the value of those coins. Or depending on your motive. So many wealthy people were putting in large amounts. That's verse 41. Verse 42 says, and one poor widow came. Now the word for poor is, this is the poorest of the poor. This woman is in abject poverty. So we have this contrast. There are the many who have much, and there is the one who is poverty stricken. And what does she do? Verse 42, she throws in the New King James translates it, two mites, which make a quadrant. Now, the word quadrants is supposed to be an explanation. Right? For Mark's Roman readers. For the rest of us, it's like, okay. So, what he is saying is, she has taken two of the smallest, least valuable Jewish coin, which is here in the Greek New Testament, a lepta, which helps everybody, right? Is that more helpful than a quadrin? This is why we look things up in the original languages to help us, right? So she takes the smallest of the coins, almost, not quite, but we use the expression paper thin. They don't weigh much of anything. They're not worth much. But she takes two of those. They are the equivalent of, and I've typed it in here for you, based on the way they did their coin values, it's 1/64 of a denarius. Remember this, right? So she's got this smallest of coins. So if it's 1/64th of a denarius, if a denarius is worth a day's wage, 1/64th of that. If she, what did I type in here? So if she works an 8-hour day, this is worth like 8 minutes. What would you get paid in 8 minutes? Does that make sense? Okay. If I did that right. In other words, it's worth what? Very little. That's Mark's point, and that's Jesus' point, is that many were giving much, and she gives nothing. So why? The logical question is, and I don't have it typed in here necessarily, but why does Jesus make a big deal out of this? Why does he make a big deal out of so little? Is it possible, and my question is it possible that this woman is poverty-stricken because the law experts have exploited her for so long? She's dependent on the temple. She's dependent on the money. Now, each of these rooms here are storehouses for other things, but this stuff was given, all of this financial transaction taking place in here was designed to help the poor, okay, to minister to people who needed help. But where did they get that money? That money also came from when the priests would go out and demand that she's a widow, why don't you sign over your house to us? We'll take care of you. Okay. In fact, if you just put your name, sign it over, we'll make sure you get some income. Yeah, well, okay. That's why Jesus gets a little upset here. The temple authorities gave to the poor this amount of money, these 2 leptas every day, so they could buy bread. That's what it would buy. It wouldn't buy fruit, vegetables, and meat and whatever. It would buy you some bread. Couldn't put anything on your bread. Wouldn't buy you butter, wouldn't buy you peanut butter, but you had bread. So you should be thankful that we gave you bread. Now, if I'm understanding correctly, the temple authorities said you could not give less than the 2 leptas. We're going to give you 2 every day so you can buy bread, which is what she gives, right? She gives up her daily allowance. She's choosing to go without bread this day, okay? But the Jews who ran the giving center in the temple said you cannot give less than these, so you couldn't give 1 of the leptas. You had to give both. This is a scam. I'm sorry, but they've got this down to an art, not a good one, but they got it down to an art where this woman is just absolutely, there is no chance of her ever making progress financially. Okay? She is totally dependent upon these people. Now, you can extrapolate all you want, all the applications of that to socialism in our day, but that's what this is here. This is religious socialism where this woman is absolutely dependent upon people who don't care for her and have no interest in her making any progress. They just want whatever she has. Okay, go ahead. Well, once a day? Her daily allowance, yeah. So what is she going to eat today? So what that tells us, though, well, it tells us many things. Tells us how wrong the system is. But secondly, it tells us well, and as described here, her great confidence in God, right? What does she value more? A loaf of bread for the day, or she wants to honor God with what he has provided for her. Okay. Does that make sense? That's the issue here. Now notice that these rich people are not taking some of their excess and giving it to her. Right? Because Jesus is not the only guy watching all of this, right? If you're interested, you can read Fruchtenbaum's, and he's got a 4-volume set on the life of Jesus called Yeshua. In volume three, pages 315 and 316, he describes how many offering boxes there were and what they were for. I'm not going to take the time to go through all of those. If you want, you can borrow my book and we can look at them together if you would like. Verse 42 then, she has put in both of these leptas, both of these coins. So that's what Jesus has observed. Now Jesus is going to exercise his authority and call his disciples over to him, and he's going to explain to them a lesson on giving. Look at verse 43. And having summoned the disciples, he's got to have the authority to summon them. This is not just, hey, do you guys, don't you come? Jesus is in control of the temple complex. So he summons them over there to himself, and he says to them, truly I say to you that this poor widow, this desperate widow, this destitute widow, as if she wants more attention drawing to herself, this desperate widow has put in more. How does the New King James say this? She has put in more than all those who have given to the treasury. Given in more, in what way? How can she give more? She's got nothing, right? But you're getting Jesus' lesson here, right? She gave more with these tiniest of coins. Worthless. These are the pennies of their culture, right? Who keeps pennies? Well, we keep coins, pick up coins. But a lot of people, they're just pennies. They're worthless. But that's what she had to live on. So Jesus makes this comparison and this stark contrast. And says she has given more. Verse 44, he explains why. Because they all put in out of their abundance, but she, out of her lack. Okay, so they have excess, she is lacking. But she gave out of what she lacked, out of her poverty. Put in all that she had, her whole livelihood, which is our English word biology, comes from this bios, those things associated, necessary for living. This is her, the New King James, livelihood. This is her ability to live. That's what she's put in today. She's put in her food allowance. She has no way to get any more, right? She's totally destitute, totally dependent. W- which leads then, and we're not going to take the time this morning, but this leads to chapter 13, where Jesus now teaches on the destruction of Jerusalem and on his second coming. And part of me wonders if what he says in chapter 13 is not fueled by what he sees here in the court of the women in verses 41 through 44. He has seen all of the inappropriate and sinful things that took place here, and when he cleansed the temple, when he takes control of the temple complex. But now that he's come up and he's in here and he sees all that is going on, people giving for a variety of reasons, but very few giving out of faith. And I think as he's coming to the end of this really long day, and now he's going to say in chapter 13, well, you can see there on your notes as he's getting ready to leave the temple complex in chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, he's going to head out through the east. He's going to go under the, probably go out this direction, go out through under the porch of Solomon, come out the eastern gate, and then go up and up the road, the Mount of Olives, and back to Bethany. Okay. But he's going to, all of these things that he has heard and observed are weighing heavy on him. And chapter 13 is, well, obviously shorter than Matthew chapters 24 and 25, right? But chapter 13 is this detailed description of what is going to come. And I've typed in for you there, leaving the temple complex. He's looking at the temple up close. And I think there's a parallel to what occurred in the book of Ezekiel as the Shekinah glory gradually departs. Remember that? And the Shekinah glory goes to the doorway, and then it goes to the gate, and then eventually it goes up, and it's gone. Remember that? I think we have a similar thing here. And Jesus has controlled these 25 football fields in size. 36 acres is roughly what the Temple Mount is composed of. One foundation stone in the temple, and that would be over here on the western side, is 45 feet long, 15 feet wide, 10 feet high, and it weighs 1.1 million pounds. One stone. Okay, it's fascinating. The western foundation wall. So let's just go through some of these things here real quick. So this western wall of the Temple Mount from the southwest up to the northwest is 1,574 feet. So what is that, 5 city blocks roughly? Right, city blocks are 300 feet. So get the idea? And in the, yeah, over here on the southeast corner, they had to build up so much, but the highest point of the foundation here is 160 feet above the bedrock. So they had to bring in, that's a long ways, okay? That's higher than this ceiling. No. And what Herod did as he built all of these things, instead of building everything plumb, which we do, what he did, because it scares people, and so he wanted to make it less intense, so to speak, but on the corners, they made the each succeeding layer set back just a little bit, so it didn't feel like it was, you know. So it's a little easier on the eyes, hence on the brain. And so you don't feel like the thing is going to tip over on you, even if it was plumb. So it slopes back. It still looks straight, but they have determined, because lasers and all this stuff, how much it slopes back just to make it a little more comfortable for you to be up next to those types of things. Josephus describes that there were 10,000 skilled workers employed as Herod was redoing all of this. That's a large number of people. Okay. But it's a government project, right? It's the CCC of Herod's day, right? All right, so one last thing, verse 2. Let's do this one. Jesus gives a corrective prophecy. In verse 1, then as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." In other words, ain't this impressive? Okay? That's the point. I mean, these are, and no offense, but these are Galilean hicks. These are guys from the boondocks, right? These guys have been out in the boonies all their life, and now they've been in Jerusalem, and they've been able to actually be in the temple for a long period of time because Jesus has been in control, and they're able to look around. And it's like, I still remember I was in high school, but going downtown Minneapolis for the first time. Remember that? And the IDS Tower, or the Fauché Tower. Remember that? And it was there. And our high school band played at something in some hotel, and it was, I think we all just kind of walked around the sidewalks, you know, bumping into people because we were looking at buildings taller than a grain elevator. Okay? We're from the boonies. We're country bumpkins. That's what these guys are. And that's what this statement is. Hey, Dad, look at how tall that is. Yeah? Okay. See what manner of stones and what buildings are here. And Jesus answered and said to him, do you see these? Do you really see this? Do you see these great buildings? Take another look. Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. What Herod had built from the bedrock up, and there's places where this was so uneven, and so they cut through bedrock. Bedrock's actually exposed up here on the north side. But what he did and brought this whole platform up and enlarged what Solomon had done. What Jesus is saying, he's not saying every last man-made piece of stone is going to be removed. That's not what he's saying. What happens is when the Romans are so ticked off with the Jews in AD 70, they actually level the entire platform. Anything above this platform is gone. Okay? The platform and all the foundation stones are still there. And when you go to Jerusalem today, especially on the west side, you will see stones from the walls laying down here, and they pushed them over, and those stones fell such a distance, they've now excavated down to the pavement stones, which were about a foot thick, limestone. Those pavement stones actually cracked from the force of those huge stones coming down and demolishing this extremely important street that ran here on the west side. That's what takes place. And it's going to happen in roughly, not quite 40, it's going to 35 to 40 years from this time. So Jesus lays out that prophecy, and that's going to be accomplished. And then verses 3 and 4, real quick, they're going to get up to the Mount of Olives. and they're going to look at the whole thing from a distance. So it's one thing to see it up close, where you can see all the different colors in the stone, and it's just fascinating, all those things, but now you're going to back up and see the whole complex. And from the Mount of Olives, you can not only see the temple complex, you can see the temple complex in the context of the whole city and in context of the surrounding hills. And you're going to, that's what Jesus does. It's an amazing teaching tool, what he does here. And he says, as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, these two sets of brothers, come to him. Verse 4, tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? There's a legitimate curiosity, but there's the question of the timing of the temple's destruction, and there's a request for a sign concerning the temple's destruction, and that is what we can deal with next week, Lord willing. So, you see how Jesus has set the stage for all of this? Tuesday's not over yet, right? He still's got this long teaching in chapter 13 about his second coming. But I think, again, I've said this before, but I think this is why we have a silent Wednesday. I think Jesus is just exhausted after all that happens on Tuesday. It's just time to take a nap, right? Stay home, rest, because you're not going to be able to do that come Thursday through Friday, right? So, all right, real quick, any questions, comments? Does that make sense for you, how all of this flows together here? Go ahead. Oh, let me back up to Solomon's temple. Solomon's temple is probably half, and what's in Ezra and Nehemiah is less than Solomon's. So what's in Ezra and Nehemiah is so to speak still here. This is just the remodel and an expansion, because it's government funded. Yeah, and Herod spends, what, 40-some years remodeling? You think your remodel has taken a while? Okay. Herod takes over 40 years to do all of this with 10,000 workers, according to Josephus. So this is huge, yeah. I think Solomon would go, oh, right? I think Nebuchadnezzar would do the same thing. You know, when he stands on his city wall and says, look at this great Babylon that I've made. Have you been to Jerusalem and seen this? Yeah. No, he hasn't. So I think one day he will. But this was the marvel of the Middle East.